Did you hear about that?
You don't believe that, do you?
Did Pope Pius XII help Hitler?
The Pope didn't help Hitler.
I read a book that said so.
You don't believe that, do you?
How can a man be infallible?
Does that mean the Pope is perfect?
Is that true?
What about the Spanish Inquisition?
Well, I heard that Peter never went to Rome.
Our teacher told us.
I saw it on television.
Is that true?
Pope fiction. Fiction.
With your host, Patrick Madrid.
Have you ever read about the Spanish Inquisition? Some books would have us believe that the popes and the Catholic Church imprisoned and even executed people just because they weren't Catholic.
Hello, I'm Patrick Madrid, publisher of Envoy Magazine and author of the book Pope Fiction, where we give answers to the myths and misconceptions some people have about the papacy. On today's show, we'll be examining the black legend of the Spanish Inquisition. How much of that legend is fact and how much is fiction? The answer to that question might surprise you. Many people believe that the Pope instituted the Spanish Inquisition because he hated Jews, Muslims, and Protestants. Some also think the popes did this because they wanted to make sure that Spanish ecclesiastical revenues continued to pour into the coffers of the Catholic Church in Rome. Here are the facts. The Catholic Church did not invent the Inquisition. Ironically, God himself invented the concept of the Inquisition. He imposed on Moses the duty of conducting an inquisition to ferret out and punish those Israelites who had defiled themselves by worshiping the false gods of the pagans. You can read about this in Numbers 25. Similarly, a religious inquisition was commanded by the Lord to be carried out on an ongoing, as-needed basis. This inquisition was intended to purge the evil in your midst when crimes such as sorcery, idolatry, and the heresies that threaten the faith of the people of Israel. God said, "If there is found among you any one of the communities which the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman, who does evil in the sight of the Lord your God, and transgresses his covenant by serving other gods, or by worshiping the sun, or the moon, or any of the host of the sky, against my command, and if, on being informed of it, you find by careful investigation that it is true and an established fact that this abomination has been committed in Israel, you shall bring the man or woman who has done the evil deed out to your city gates and stone him to death. The testimony of two or three witnesses is required for putting a person to death. No one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness." Now that passage comes from Deuteronomy 17, verses 2 through 7. And we can see there the essential elements of the Inquisition. A. If there is reason to believe that a member of the community is secretly practicing false or heretical religion, you must punish him, God says. B. The Lord says you must carefully investigate the person under suspicion to verify if the charge of heresy is true. C. There must be a trial in which witnesses and testimony are brought forth. D. If the person is found to be guilty of this religious crime, in other words, if the guilt has been proved by the established facts of the case, then the death penalty is to be imposed. And finally, according to God's plan in Deuteronomy, this inquisition and punishment is meted out in order to protect the community from being contaminated by the contagion of idolatry and heresy. Now, all the kingdoms and states in Europe during the late Middle Ages and beyond were Catholic, thoroughly Catholic. The state was so closely intertwined with the church, it so closely identified itself with the Catholic faith, that religious heresy in Europe at that time took on a completely different meaning than it would today, or as it did in the time of the early church. Conditions were so different during the time of the European Inquisitions that it can be very difficult for our modern-day Catholic sensibilities, and for many non-Catholics, to imagine a situation in which heresy would be regarded as a crime. It seems strange to us now, but this matter was seen very differently in those days. And that's an important point for us to keep in mind as we try to understand really what the Inquisition was. By the time the late Middle Ages rolled around, the church and the state throughout Europe had become so closely aligned that any heretical attack on the church was perceived by the state to be an attack on society itself. Don't forget, society in those days was thoroughly Catholic. So if a heresy went after a doctrine of the faith, it was upsetting the entire social order. So by the time we get to the Spanish Inquisition, the most notorious of the several that were carried out, the religious attacks arrayed against the Catholic Church had taken on a martial or military quality. Because now as never before, religions such as Islam or Protestantism had the muscle of armies and navies behind them. This threat that was posed to the Church wasn't merely theological. These other ideologies could back up their threat with the force of arms, and they did. That's exactly what happened in 15th century Spain. It prompted the establishment of the Inquisition there. It was a special ecclesiastical court headed by one or more judges who were appointed by the Pope as inquisitors. Their job was to help the state combat heresy. The purpose of the Inquisition was to protect the Church and the state from the danger of heresy by investigating to make sure that people who were charged with the crime or people who were accused of the crime either were or were not guilty of it. Now, this concept, again, it may seem bizarre to us now, living in this modern era. We live in a pluralistic society that maintains this posture of allowing all sorts of religious and philosophical systems to coexist and thrive side by side. The United States, for example, was established largely on the principles of equality. Now, I say largely because certain issues pertaining to race or today now with pertaining to unborn human beings, inequality is the institutional position. But in general, equality was the theme for the United States government's structure. But the United States sprang from a rejection of religious turmoil in Europe. And many Protestant settlers, such as the Pilgrims, wanted to get far away from the Protestant Inquisitions that they were being persecuted under and suffering under at the hand of other Protestants, other Christians, especially those in England. But before the Protestant Reformation erupted, let's move back now before Martin Luther and get back into the era when Europe was entirely Catholic. We can see that this idea of a forced separation between church and state, the way we know it in the United States today, was completely alien to Europe at the time, because the Catholic Church was part of the very fabric of society. It didn't matter which country you lived in. It was the glue that held medieval European society together. So that's why when the Church was attacked by a heresy, such as, let's say, the medieval heresies of Catharism or the Waldensians, the state understood itself to be under attack as well. If the Church were thrown into turmoil by a heresy, that meant that all the citizens of the realm were also in turmoil, which meant that society, in fact, the government itself, was in danger. Consequently, the state and the Church acted aggressively to repel or extinguish those threats of heresy. And it's a fact, whether we like it or not today, it's a fact that the two main tools that were used by all governments in those days to combat crime of any sort was those two tools were torture and capital punishment. We cannot forget that in medieval Europe, criminals of any kind were dealt with very harshly under the law. And in those societies, heresy was considered a criminal offense, not only against the Church, but also against the state. And this is where the so-called black legend of the Spanish Inquisition comes into play. Like most of the other Pope fictions, we must examine the Inquisition, and especially the Spanish Inquisition, in its historical context to get a full understanding of what really went on and why. Let's now take a moment to look at this setting that we find ourselves in at the beginning of the Inquisition. 15th century Spain was a kingdom, it's actually several allied kingdoms, that was threatened by powerful outside forces, the most formidable of which was Islam. Now, recall that in those days, in the 15th century, in the centuries before, and even for some time after, Islam, it went across North Africa, it went across the Mediterranean world, using primarily armies to subjugate the peoples that were in its way. They don't do that now, of course, but that was the method of the struggle between Islam and the rest of the world, mainly the Christian world. So Spain was one of those conquered territories. It had been at war with the Muslim powers for over 700 years. Now, just imagine for a minute. Try to imagine. I can't imagine what it would be like to live in a country that had been at war for 700 years. It's almost mind-boggling to imagine the kind of never-ending stress that would be bound to take its toll on a nation of Catholics who are in a constant state of struggle for the survival of their religion and their way of life. These Spaniards had lived for so long under the Muslim threat of violence and even the annihilation of their Catholic faith that the very fabric of Spanish culture was embroidered with this fear of invasion, this fear of subterfuge, the concern that there were people who were actively plotting to overthrow the Spanish way of life, and of course Catholicism. This, by the way, is not meant to impugn Muslims. I mean, Muslims generally are very peaceable people, but historically speaking, it is a fact that the Muslim armies were armies of occupation in Spain at the time. Now, the Catholic Church and the Catholics in Spain, they were very well aware of how Christians elsewhere in northern Africa, Palestine, and elsewhere, how they fared under the Muslim armies that came in and essentially subjugated the entire region. They knew that there were other regions where Islam had conquered decisively, as it had tried to conquer in the Iberian Peninsula for those 700 years. And they had seen all the sad episodes in which Christian culture had been all but obliterated, and nothing discernibly Catholic was left standing. It wasn't until the Spanish monarchs, Isabella and Ferdinand, ascended to the throne in 1489 that the Moorish or Muslim occupiers were finally driven out of Spain. In fact, in 1480, the Muslim Turks took the Italian city of Otranto and they executed half its population. Try to imagine this. Some 12,000 people perished under the sword from that invading Muslim army that was on its way marching back to Spain. They killed all the Catholic clergy, all the religious, the nuns, anybody they could lay their hands on who was in a religious habit. In fact, the poor Archbishop of Otranto, he suffered a particularly cruel death. He was very much alive and awake and was held down and sawn in half. Now, many of those who were killed had first been offered their lives if they would convert to Islam. The souls of many unknown martyrs for Christ ascended to glory that day, and those who survived the slaughter were not in a very pleasant situation themselves. Some 10,000 inhabitants of the city who escaped death were herded aboard Turkish ships and taken away to the oblivion of slavery. So clearly, this type of aggression was a threat not only to the bordering kingdoms of Europe, but also to Western Christianity itself. Spain was very aware of this. And the message of what happened in Italy at Otranto was very quickly communicated to Spain, and they realized these invading armies, they intend to come back to Spain and take away our faith as they did in these other places. The faith in the East had already been devastated by Muslim armies, and it appeared that the same would be in store for the West. So this fear of imminent threat, this fear of an Islamic attack, it formed much of the basis for the Spanish monarchs petitioning the Pope at the time to allow them to implement the court in their country of the Spanish Inquisition. Now, in Spain at this time, there were numerous what we would call in Spanish conversos or converts. These were Muslims or Jews, even perhaps some Protestants at a later point, who converted to Catholicism. Now, historians say that at the time of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, there may have been as many as tens of thousands of what we would call false converts living in Spain. What that means is these were not merely converts to the faith, but these people outwardly professed to be Catholic. They maybe held high positions in society, but secretly they were still practicing their former religion, whether it was Islam or Judaism. And so one of the things that was very alarming and, of course, very scandalous to the population was that it was discovered that there were even priests who were these false converts. And sadly, tragically, some of these priests were actually mocking the Holy Mass even as they celebrated it. They had converted for the sake of achieving some prominence or some position in society, but yet their conversion to the Catholic faith was a sham. Now, the government looked, as you might imagine, very unhappily on this phenomenon of conversos who were falsely converts, And they regarded them as potential traitors, people who were likely to side with Muslims if the Muslims should show up on the border and try to attack. The government feared that these false converts would use subterfuge, or they would use some kind of deceit or collusion to help the Turks invade Spain again. The problem for the government was that it was impossible for these untrained government officials, they had no training in theology, it would be impossible for them to really tell who was a false convert and in potentially a traitor, and who was actually a true Catholic and would be loyal. Outwardly, these converts appeared to be regular Catholics. As I say, some were priests, they taught in the seminaries, there were people in government positions, and it was very difficult for the government to realize how to proceed. There was enough evidence to show that some of these actually were plotting secretly against the government, using their outward Catholicism as a disguise to shield them from suspicion. Now, at this time in Spain, there was no illegality about being a Muslim or being a Jew. That was not illegal at all. In fact, to use an analogy, in most states in the United States, if you have a gun rack in your pickup truck and you could put a hunting rifle or some other sort of long rifle up there, you can drive around town. As long as the police can see it, there's no problem. They know that you have it there for hunting. But if the police pull you over and if your gun is not on the gun rack, but instead it's stashed under the seat of your car or behind the seat where it's concealed, that gives the policeman the impression that you're hiding something, that you've got the gun stashed away because you don't want to be noticed as carrying a gun. So immediately you fall under suspicion, and it's a reasonable suspicion. People would say, why are you hiding this? And that was the mindset of the Spanish government. They wanted to be able to identify and prosecute the traitors, but they also saw that they had a duty to protect innocent people from being falsely accused by their enemies. And there were cases where many people were falsely accused of being heretical or secretly practicing another religion, and they were brought before the Spanish Inquisition, they were tried, and they were let free. A good example of that would be St. Teresa of Avila. So King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella realized that they neither had the expertise in this area, nor did their government ministers. So in November of 1478, the monarchs officially petitioned Pope Sixtus IV to allow the establishment of the Spanish Inquisition to help them solve the problem. Now, as I mentioned, this was not merely a punitive action to try to find those people who were committing this crime of heresy, but they were also there, they were also instituting the Inquisition as a shield of justice to protect those who were truly innocent. So the falsely accused would not have to worry about being imprisoned or punished in some other way. Now, this idea of the court being established, it was important that these inquisitors be competent to determine whether these accusations about being heretical were true. Now, their judgments were accepted definitively by the Spanish crown, and by the standards of the day, the court of the Inquisition was, in almost all instances, very fair. The testimony was carefully weighed. If there were potential witnesses who were known to be enemies or in conflict with the person who was accused, their testimony was not allowed in the court. Accusations for heresy were very carefully investigated, and most of them were actually dismissed early in the proceedings. But those who were found to be heretics and who admitted to it were punished. And the seriousness of their crime would determine the degree of punishment. Now, much of is often made. There's a lot of, you might say, ballyhoo that's out there about executions carried out by the Inquisition. This is true and untrue. First, the ecclesiastical officials, the inquisitors themselves, executed no one. Rather, those who were guilty, and by guilty, that would be somebody who confessed to a crime. These were turned over to the civil officials, who then carried out their own punishments. Interestingly, not many people realize that the first level of punishment, if you confessed to having been a false convert, was you were imprisoned, or you were fined, or there was some other serious but not life-threatening punishment. If later on you were found to have lapsed back into it again, and then were caught, the punishment at that point would be death. Not the first time, but the second time. Second thing to remember is that, contrary to the popular myth that's out there these days, the number of executions was relatively small, relatively low, at least compared to the numbers that people bandy about. The number was probably about 2,000, all told, throughout Spain and the Spanish Inquisition. Now, granted, this is still a tragically high number, but it's very far from the grotesquely exaggerated claims of some of the more hysterical anti-Catholic accounts that are out there. Now, depending on what you're reading or who's telling the story about the Black Legend, you'll get a different number. But the one thing that these legends all have in common is that they vastly overstate the number of those who perished as a punishment after being tried by the Inquisition. I read, for example, in one book, particularly outlandish example, where they exaggerated the number to the point of it being 90 million people who were killed by the Spanish Inquisition. Now, of course, we don't want in any way to make light of the deaths of people that did occur, but the absurdity of that figure really becomes clear when you look at the demographics of Europe, Western Europe at the time. In order to kill 90 million people, or 50 or 30 million, the Catholic Church in Spain would have to have killed every single man, woman, and child in Spain, and in much of the rest of Europe, and then gone out and imported millions more people into Spain simply for the purpose of killing them. And that, of course, is absurd. The fact remains, though, that there were serious problems with the Inquisition. And it's true that torture was used in some instances, although critics forget that whether or not we like it today, torture was an accepted practice in medieval society. We're not apologizing for torture in the sense that we're not trying to defend it. We're not trying to excuse it. But we need to maintain a sense of historical perspective here. We recoil from the idea of torture, and we should, but let's not forget that even in the United States, until just a few decades ago, law enforcement officers routinely tortured the uncooperative suspect. In fact, in our colloquial American slang, we talk about giving someone the third degree, if you ever use that phrase, or he got the rubber hose treatment. Those terms come from the actual fact of violent interrogation methods used by police officers in this country, in the United States. So we can't forget that this kind of torture was actually legal in the United States until just a few decades ago. Now, the records of the Spanish Inquisition show that there were repeated incidents of church officials intervening on behalf of accused people when they found out of excesses or cruelties in the interrogations. Now, there were some good things that did come out of the Inquisition. We can cover those briefly. First, it did uncover many of these pseudo-Catholics who were masquerading and potentially disloyal to the state. Second, it shielded these innocent people who were falsely accused, and their innocence was later proved in court. Third, it helped prevent the opportunities for Muslim invasions into Spain. Finally, it was also a very helpful antidote for when, a short time later, this paranoia about witchcraft swept throughout Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. Spain, for the most part, was spared that convulsion. Now, when we look at the Spanish Inquisition, we have to avoid two extremes. First, we can't make the mistake of condemning the institution of the Inquisition out of hand. There were some good and positive things that occurred and came out of the Inquisition. On the other hand, we can't fail to recognize the reality of terrible abuses that did go on in the Spanish Inquisition. We don't defend those abuses. We don't seek in this show in any way to excuse them or minimize them, because the fact is there were evil actions that were carried out by Catholics in the name of the papacy and of the church itself. Rather, what we're trying to do here is to show that the Inquisition, and in particular the Spanish Inquisition, while flawed, and regardless of its admitted cruelties, it doesn't injure or disprove the Catholic teaching on the infallibility of the popes. Why? Because papal infallibility, as we've learned in previous episodes of Pope Fiction, falls strictly into the province of teaching doctrine. Now, the Inquisition was concerned with discipline, the civil and legal issues that surrounded heresy. Or to put it a different way, infallibility only comes into play when the Pope is formally teaching doctrine to the whole Church in his official capacity as Supreme Pontiff. But the Inquisition was merely a legal entity that acted in the name of the Pope to determine how well or poorly people accused of heresy actually followed the teachings of the Church. Well, by the standards of our day, the Spanish Inquisition is often misunderstood. We do know it was a fair and reasonable court for the time. It is not the bloodthirsty, out-of-control anti-heresy machine that many people thought it was. but it was actually a legitimate and useful tool that was sometimes misused. Well, we've run out of time for today's show, but I'd like to thank you for being here for this episode of Pope Fiction. And I'd like to invite you to come back next time when we will tackle more myths and misconceptions about the papacy. I'm Patrick Madrid. I'm the publisher of Envoy Magazine, the author of the book Pope Fiction. I ask you to join me in continuing to pray for our Holy Father, the Pope, that God will guide him and strengthen him. And I wish you all the best in Christ.